From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this edition of Press Conference USA. Well, born out of the need to educate people and tear down stigmas associated with managing menstruation, Menstrual Hygiene Day was created and is recognized worldwide every year on May 28th. Women and girls around the world suffer every month unnecessarily from a lack of information and access to products that they need. The suffering is magnified further without proper sanitation infrastructure and educational opportunities, health, and overall social status are affected in many areas of the world, all due to the natural biological process of menstruation. As a result, millions of women and girls are kept from reaching their full potential. During pandemics, such as the global COVID-19 pandemic, the problem is exacerbated. The objectives of menstrual hygiene management are to bring awareness to challenges young girls and women face by breaking the silence, raising awareness, and changing negative social norms around menstrual hygiene management. Also, a big goal is to engage decision makers to increase the political priority for management of menstrual hygiene at the global, national, and local levels. Well, joining me via Skype to provide insight into this often overlooked issue facing women and girls worldwide is Dr. Julita Onabanjo, Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA. Also joining the program via Skype is my colleague, VOA television reporter and host, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick. Thank you both for taking the time to join me on Skype to talk about this issue.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Onabanjo, your agency, the UNFPA, promotes that menstruation is not just an issue for women and girls, but rather it is a human rights issue. Why is this a human rights issue?
It fundamentally is a human rights issue because indeed many women, in fact, half of the population of the world menstruate at some point in time. And if they haven't got the access to not only their ability to ensure that that is done safely, hygienically, with the confidence and the comfort and with dignity, it is a violation of a right to access, a right to choice, a right to empowerment. And fundamentally, we put menstrual health and menstrual health and hygiene as a sexual and reproductive health and rights issue. So indeed, we think about it from many aspects and not just from an aspect of being able to get access to a product, but really from what it provides for empowerment of a woman, for her freedom and her choice, and to really attain her full potential.
Well, so many girls see that time of the month as a sickness or a disease. And not necessarily those just living in developing countries, but developed countries as well, leading to a lot of neglect and discrimination. So why does the stigma of menstruation persist today?
I think that's a really important question to be asking, because for such an important, normal, healthy reality that women and girls go through both in developing and worldwide, and the fact that it is part of the biology of reproduction of humanity. Indeed, it still gets covered in this shroud of secrecy and taboo that's very much driven by the social and structural context with which many of the issues around sexual and reproductive health for women and girls sort of, you know, are embedded on. And so really, it is important that we continue to challenge some of these, and indeed the movement around menstrual health and hygiene has begun to tear down some of these taboos that have really not only influenced the issues of gender and gender empowerment and gender issues and inequality issues, but also some of the social cultural norms that really have surrounded the issues of menstruation and indeed have really limited our ability to not only put this as an important priority, but to actually be able to, you know, get progress in terms of the rights to menstrual health and to menstrual hygiene and to women's rights in general.
Haiti, you are one of the hosts of VOA's Our Voices television program. I'm sure you all touch on many women's issues. What would you like to say regarding stigmas attached to menstruation?
You know, I actually want to add to something that Dr. Anabunjo was talking about in terms of this being a taboo. We have a lot of conversations with women around the continent. And I mean, growing up on the continent and being a reporter, I have had this conversation many times. And of course, being a woman myself, being a young girl and remembering that when I think of my period as a young girl, immediately, I think about that and shame. I think about the first moment I got it. You know, when people talk about any crisis, where were you when that happened, right? Where was I, what I was doing? And it's still a story that sometimes I tell my mother and I talk about it, how I felt in that moment. I was confused. I didn't know what was going on. I was 13. But then I soon came to realize a great aunt of mine was around and she said, oh, we've got to clean this up. We've got to. And immediately you think you did something wrong. And the shame that goes with it. And that conversation starts there with, so I have to feel bad that this happened to me. And I think that's where it starts. Whenever something happens to your body as a young woman, there's almost automatically a shame attached to it. You have to hide it, but it isn't something that is easy to hide. You think of all the moments that you've had, an embarrassing moment where you have stained your clothes. These are uncomfortable conversations, but they happen to women. I was a young woman, I was in a professional environment, and I stained my pants and another woman pointed it out to me very publicly, and it was embarrassing. When I think of my period, I think of only embarrassing, shameful moments that I have had. And I think that is such a big part of the problem, is that when we talk about menstruation, the word shame comes to mind. And the shame is, it's the woman's burden to bear. And we need to change that conversation around that. Teach young girls about their rights. We should also teach them not just, you know, about hygiene and their bodies, but that this is normal, and we should teach boys the same thing.
And I just wanted to pick up with Heidi's point, because I think that experience is very typical in terms of understanding that, particularly for, and for UNFPA, we really focus in on the 10-year-old girl and that really important and pivotal time in her life as she goes through puberty into adolescence. And what happens at that moment in time and that period in time really affects her whole future sexual and reproductive health, attitudes and behaviors. And it's very different and diverse across a life cycle. And this is one of the things that UNFPA has tried to look at, is the experience that one gets through a life course. And we call it from menarche, when you have that first period, to menopause. And throughout that, in different stages of that life course, you experience menstruation in different ways and you adapt to it in different ways. But also settings and contexts are very important. And so, you know, it is the 10-year-old girl going to school and getting her period and for the first time and had not even realized what that was going to be. But it's also issues of, when we're seeing this more, of issues of how do women who are incarcerated or in prison get access to the sorts of supplies that they need. And again, you know, very much part of some of the societies that we've seen and the youth, particularly in the context of prisons, of this as a form of deprivation and further stigmatization by withdrawing products for women who are in prisons. And then we have a new evolving area around transgender and gender non-conforming persons, and what does that mean? Or people with disabilities, and how do they manage the choices about their contraceptives? Or for us as well, we work very much with refugees, internally displaced people and people on the move. And again, how do they deal with some of these issues and the choices and the experiences that they have? So very much from a life course, but also from a context, how we continually face and see these evolving perspectives around, you know, menstrual experiences. And how do we ensure that as we think about programs and policies, we can encapsulate some of that as well?
And even to add to that, in some areas of the world, menstruation is believed to indicate that girls are ready for marriage and sexual activity. This is leaving them very vulnerable to child marriage and even sexual violence. So how do young girls and women deal with these cultural barriers that prevent them from being empowered and instead are made to feel victimized and ashamed and even scared?
I think it does really start with that education and awareness and information that many times, and Heidi spoke about it, how it was an aunt who was the person who helped her through and talked to her about what it means to have a period for the first time. And so in communities and societies, that's where really one needs to begin and start having those conversations. And really before even puberty and before menarche starts, so that those conversations are not only first are the myths and misinformation corrected, but also education about body literacy, about empowerment. And one of the things that UNFPA does is works with governments, but also with society around sexuality education, life skills, empowerment issues, issues of bodily autonomy and agency, that we start as young as possible and ensure that girls have access to that. Now, some of that is in school, some of that is out of school, some of that is in communities, some of that is really first working with parents and communities to understand these issues and what it can affect, and then using them as agents, but also with young people themselves.
Haiti?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. That is so important because, you know, at the end of the day, this is an economic issue. And when you talk to people, whether it be families, politicians, communities, this is also about their future, not just that one girl's future, because it's a cycle, right? When we exclude, when girls have to go through this and in many cases have to drop out of school, we exclude them essentially. They're excluded from an education. And in that process of exclusion begins in her life. She's excluded from an education, excluded from an opportunity to then go to university to get any sort of training. And ultimately, she's excluded from the economy. She's excluded from the middle class that we're trying to build in many African countries. And we leave her in a cycle of poverty. And I think it's sometimes where people struggle to make that connection between a pad and poverty or pad and economic prosperity. But there's that domino effect that starts in her life, and that this is also a political issue. If you look at countries that have actually, you know, on the continent started getting, in at least in part, I want to use Kenya for an example, you know, in some ways they're a bit ahead of many even Western countries where tampons and sanitary pads are still considered luxury items. But Kenya repealed a VAT tax on tampons and pads about, what is it now, 16 or so years ago, so that women can pay less for that. And the government budgets for the distribution of sanitary pads in schools. Every year they budget for that. That's a good start, but that needed, they needed to apply political pressure from politicians, from civil society, and that's also where we as the media can play a role in this. So, you know, it has on so many levels, there's this domino effect, not only in people's lives and communities, but if you start to make people understand that this is about your future as well, I think that needs to be a big part of the conversation as well.
And I think, Heidi, you've got it right on, because indeed it's absolutely an economic effect. And there is the term that you may have heard, period poverty, that really plays out that notion again of, you know, not only the exclusion, whether it's starting at, you know, girls not being able to go to school and therefore their whole sort of participation in education and their ability to really, again, move on into the workplace. Women in the workplace who also, because of certain issues around obviously menstrual pain, or in some situations where because they're part of an informal sector or a migrant workforce, every day's pay sets their family back, it sets their community back, it sets development back, as you said. And so, you know, they can't just afford that. So both at the individual level in terms of just the economic empowerment of women in general and just being able to get out of that cycle of poverty, you know, whether it's through work, education, but also the broader ramifications on our efforts, as you say, in many developing countries to really put an end to poverty and really ensure sustained development. The example from Kenya is a fantastic one, and indeed many of the countries in the developing world are looking to these sorts of examples. We also have examples in South Africa, recently have examples in Zimbabwe, which was a different case where indeed when they did tax exemption on the raw material in the hope that it will reduce the prices of menstrual products, because of the broader economic challenges and deprivation of their money, it actually didn't translate into really more affordable products for individuals. But in Kenya, and in that particular example, there were, you know, there's been research that also looks at the vulnerability that affordability of products has to women and girls and the risks that they do take. And you talked about it not only in terms of, you know, families then having to make decisions about, do we, now that she's menstruating, she's ready for marriage, so do we send her off into an early child marriage? Or she's now in a situation where, because her family can't afford to buy her the pad, she takes the risks and goes with, in the case of Kenya, the boda driver. And these are motorcycle drivers to actually get her supply.
And we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Dr. Julita Onobanjo, Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA. Also joining the panel is my colleague, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick, VOA television reporter and co-host of VOA's Our Voice television show. I'm Kim Lewis. Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener in Nigeria, Gloria Olabadin. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com, or you can like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Now back to our program, addressing issues on managing menstrual hygiene, a top priority for women and girls worldwide. Well, Dr. Onobanjo, what is your main concern for management of menstrual hygiene during this COVID-19 pandemic? And what areas of the world are you most concerned about?
This year's Menstrual Hygiene Day, the theme is periods don't stop for pandemics. And really, in a way, the current coronavirus pandemic is really, as you had said earlier, exacerbating the issue and really shining a light on some of the really still challenges that we face in terms of responding to this. First is the whole approach that many countries have taken to respond to the virus, and rightly so, in terms of lockdowns and restrictions and the physical distancing and movement. And what that has created is actually a challenge for us, where many times a lot of the work that we do, for example, the issue around ensuring that young girls get access to free sanitary products, many times the school system is the conduit or supply system for that. And so when schools are closed, and we're seeing that in India, we're seeing that in many parts of Africa, those free sanitary pads actually get discontinued as well. So really, that's one big issue that we're trying to ensure, that as countries look at their COVID response, that they really also put a menstrual health lens on and recognize that, okay, so if we're going to give social grants or cushion or food packages, that we should also ensure that menstrual pads and products are part of that. The second is this whole issue of confinement, whether it's self-managed quarantine or whether it's in official facilities for quarantine. And then a real lack of sense of recognizing that this is the most essential thing that you also need in those confinement spaces, and therefore they need to be part of those facilities. But also in the context of many of our countries where, and I take townships particularly, or slum areas, where the confinement really in a lockdown situation not only exacerbate some of the gender norms and stereotypes that are attached to, and as Heidi had said earlier, this sort of shame issue in the household. You know, how do you practice that privacy around issues of menstrual management? The other area is obviously in the supply chain distribution. And you know, in the initial part, we even saw local manufacturers moving and shifting to obviously developing really important life-saving protective gears. But you also found local manufacturers of pads and reusable pads particularly also shifting. And so really, you know, again, how do we ensure that the stock levels for supplies, the shipping, the whole procurement around supply chain for menstrual products is still kept online? And maybe for us as UNFPA, one of the most critical issues is around the disruption of sexual and reproductive health services, and particularly, you know, with health workers. And we, you know, 70% of our health workers in developing countries are women. And so they are menstruating and they're working hard. And they're wearing these protective gears that really also make it very uncomfortable as they practice and as they deliver their services. So that's something that we've looked particularly into as well, is how do they manage their dignity and safety, especially as they wear PPE, but especially as they also deliver sexual and reproductive health services. I do want to mention something about menstrual health, because in as much as we normalize menstruation and we say it's natural, there are menstrual related discomforts and disorders, whether it's abdominal uterine bleeding, it's fibroids, it's endometriosis, it's just menorrhagia and pain that goes with that. But sometimes we really should not normalize, because they could be signs of things that are worse. And I do feel those opportunities to ensure that everything is right and everything is natural and normal, particularly sexual and reproductive health services or gynecological services seen as non-essential in this time of COVID, I think we could lose opportunities to ensure that those touch points with the health center around a comprehensive set of sexual and reproductive health care, including just, you know, the contraceptive use. Many times the contraceptive choice and the menstrual experience are also linked. And you know, how do we just ensure the continuity of that? That said, we also see this as a great time to innovate, and we're seeing some really important things around dispensing of menstrual products, around, you know, the opportunities for those conversations between parents and boys and their children around, you know, sexual and reproductive health, but also around menstrual health. We're seeing new forms of apps and helplines that tackle the issues of period sort of taboos, but also information. And so I think that's the flip side of obviously all what we're seeing with COVID.
Yes, Haiti, I know you wanted to share an experience on the COVID pandemic.
I was just listening to Dr. Onabanjo too, and it just everything she said is completely true. And it's made me think about this broader conversation we're having right now on the continent. And I'm sure, Dr. Onabanjo, in your field of work, you're very much involved in this conversation about, are we really going to lose all the gains we have made now in terms of women's empowerment, particularly since we're focusing on that? You know, what do we do with this moment in time? Is this an opportunity for us to really just slip back and lose the gains we've made? Or as a continent, is this really an opportunity to take a step forward and look at how we respond to the issues in our society? Because COVID-19 has laid bare so many structural issues, so many health issues. I'm curious to know, is it difficult to speak to governments about this issue right now when hospitals, all the attention is going to be on people who are suffering from illnesses related to COVID-19, whether it's, you know, TB patients, HIV, those living with HIV, and of course people who have the virus. But, you know, they're grappling with that issue now. Women's other health issues might be put off right now.
It depends on the government. We have some governments who already are very primed about the issues of sexual reproductive health and rights, believe it's fundamental to their own development, and have integrated it well, including the issues of gender equality and definitely the issues of gender-based violence and femicide and some of what we've seen in terms of those very ingrained gender norms and patriarchy in societies and socialization. And so some of that has been on Earth and in those countries, then bringing to them this issue of you must keep sexual and reproductive health, menstrual health, women's health, women's rights, gender equality, and particularly protection from gender-based violence in the center of your response. They get it and they do it. So it's part and parcel. And South Africa is a great example where you have cabinet ministers who are speaking out on these issues. You know, the minute it's brought to their attention that in this pharmacy, pads are behind a strip line that is considered non-essential, they take the strip away and they make it kind of sexable, depending on where we've got to. And clearly in countries where they're still hiding behind a number of power structures in vis-a-vis women and the roles they play. You see fertility in those set contexts. They don't even have access to contraceptives without a consent from their husbands. It's much harder to navigate these issues. So it's a varied picture in developing countries and particularly on the African continent. And there you almost have to look for these very strong champions of change who can continuously help you bring this to the forefront.
You have talked about menstrual health. And of course, it for some women, it's a very difficult time of the month because there are menstrual disorders. And also there's maybe a lack of education regarding men. What are men's role in this? How does a woman get the man to be supportive of her during this time?
It's everybody's role, is communities, men, and we start really with boys and how we again ensure, because a lot of the menstrual bullying that girls get is really from boys not even understanding what this is about. And so you really have to start, you know, really young and with boys and work that through. You know, for men, it's a woman's issue, and so they put it aside, but really bringing that to their attention. And nowadays, as men become much more part of parenting their daughters, these are the questions that they really also need to ask, you know, and answer. And so really educating them as well through what this means and what it is something that we've really, as UNFPA, looked to men as partners in really ensuring that we can move forward on that. You know, we have big campaigns like He for She, Men as Partners, but also in parts of our world, we also, you know, look at what we call husband schools, where we actually gather men in society and really spend time with them to have these conversations around what women are experiencing. It really plays out because, of course, you know, many times they're in the decision-making roles, and if they just set this aside and say, oh, but it's a normal thing, you know, then policies never get really reflecting what they need to do in terms of the ability, whether it's in the workplace, to ensure that a woman, if she is feeling pain, should be able to not be penalized for that.
Haiti.
I think that is so important. Dr. Anabanjo spoke about this earlier, also about starting the conversation in the home. I think I grew up with two brothers and now I have sons. And how do you have that conversation with boys about how a girl's empowerment is good for them too? I think later on in life, the conversation we need to have with men too about how women's empowerment and economic freedom is good for them too. Don't just talk to them about other women. I think when you talk to them in terms of their mothers, their sisters, their daughters, especially their daughters, you'll see the conversation starts to change and even the look in a man's eyes starts to change, because some men might not think their wives or their mothers are, you know, worthy of that economic empowerment, but there are many men who believe that their daughters can do just about anything.
Dr. Anabanjo, I just wanted to give you the last word on this. Do you see young people leading the way to empower themselves on sexual and reproductive health?
Totally. I think we've got some amazing young people who are really just moving on these issues, giving agency and voice. And I think that's what's changed, particularly in the developing world, where they are now having those platforms to actually voice some of these and speak truth to power. And we see them do that extremely well in terms of bringing their life experiences to the forefront and really not only just speaking to the heart of some of these issues, but also being the change that they want to see. We have a group of on the continent, not only a coalition for menstrual health management of 500 organizations strong, of which many are young people. And they're looking at it from, you know, the water and sanitation perspective, from the environment, from just whether they're gender non-conforming and what does that mean, those who are most vulnerable in terms of disabilities and on the move. And they're bringing perspectives that I think many of the times we miss as we program and think we know quite a bit. So for UNFPA, we put young people front and center in terms of how we think through issues and how we develop policy and approaches moving forward.
Dr. Julita Anabanjo, Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA. Also joining us was my colleague, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick, VOA television reporter and co-host of VOA's Our Voices television show. Thank you both for your precious time during these very challenging times and for sharing your insights via Skype. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Pikesville, Maryland. I'm Kim Lewis. Be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.